Great to have you along here as we talk head, neck, and oral cancers with two guests today. Dr. Timothy McCullough, one of our guests, otolaryngologist, chairs the Department of Otolaryngology in the University of Wisconsin Hospitals and Clinics. He's one of our guests. The other, Rachel Kramer, is a clinical speech-language pathologist in the Department of Surgery and Otolaryngology, and great to have her with us. She was with us about a year ago, and so we're glad to have her back as well to talk about these cancers. I have a friend who has a stage 4 cancer and came up as thought it was a pimple in his the back of his neck, and he's been treated for it and being treated for it, but it's something that can happen to I guess pretty much any of us, and so it's well worth talking about identifying it, what's going on in the area of research and how to deal with it. Certainly on the speech-language side, there are things often to consider as well. So we're pleased to have them with us and invite your questions and comments as we move along today. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us at talk@wpr.org, and we'd love to hear from you. Rachel Kramer, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Appreciate having you back. Dr. Tim McCullough, thank you so much for being with us as well.
Larry, thanks for having us.
What kinds of cancers are considered cancers of the head and neck most often? We'll turn to you, Dr. McCullough.
You know, I think it's obviously a great question. And the cancer of the head and neck is a regional phenomenon. And most individuals would think of this as a mucosally based phenomenon, i.e. oral cavity, tongue, voice box, or larynx. But it can include areas such as the jaw or the nasal pharynx or the sinuses. Even the thyroid gland is in the region of the head and neck. The skin, as you mentioned, Larry, can be a head and neck-related malignancy. And so, again, within that region, there's a lot of areas that have potential for cancerous growths.
How common are they? Is there one type of person who's more likely to have it, or is it an age-related thing?
You know, again, it's relatively stable, at least, and partly I think that has to do with the changes in trends with tobacco use. It is a disorder that we see in both genders. We see it throughout the lifespan. Young children occasionally will end up with sarcomas of the head and neck. But it's, again, when people commonly think of head and neck malignancies, they're going to think of a middle-aged or older population. Mm-hmm. And they oftentimes associate it with cigarette smoking. But I would like your listeners to understand that that's not necessarily the case. We will see individuals in our clinics that have never smoked a cigarette. Are of younger age, under the age of 40, but it will also occur in patients that are in their 90s. And so we're dealing with a whole group of individuals from a variety of different backgrounds, and it kind of depends on the site and the primary type of tumor, but it can be anybody.
And Rachel, clinical speech language, that comes to play for many people who have these cancers?
Well, I'm one of the multiple disciplines that will get involved in the rehabilitation of patients after undergoing treatment for head and neck cancer. So patients may be undergoing surgery, radiation, chemotherapy, or a combination of those modalities. And because of the effects of the cancer as well as the treatment, they may have trouble with their speech and swallowing after receiving treatment. And so I would be the one to treat them to rehabilitate their speech and swallowing.
Let me give that number again. If you'd like to join in, call us at 1-800-642-1234. Or email us at talk@wpr.org. Dr. McCullough, you mentioned smoking and as one thing, but I guess smokeless tobacco or snuff particularly risky for people?
You know, I think it definitely fits into the category of one of the risks or one of the problems that people run into with chewing tobacco or smokeless tobacco is head and neck malignancies. I think it's, again, important to recognize that any form of tobacco has carcinogens in it, and whether it's smokeless or smoked, it has the potential of leading to cancerous problems down the road. So we certainly encourage individuals to avoid tobacco products, both the smokeless and the smoked forms. We see in our population, I think, mostly cigarette smokers, partly just because of the prevalence of that phenomenon compared to smokeless tobaccos. But smokeless tobaccos can lead to a variety of things, including lip cancers and oral cavity cancers, and occasionally in young individuals. I think it's young individuals that tend to do that because they can do it while they're doing other things, including athletic events and working. And so they'll have a long history of smokeless tobacco when we'll see them. They'll be 25 years old and have a 10-year history of smokeless tobacco use. Then it's a problem if a young person ends up with a big head and neck malignancy.
Yeah. Are there some typical symptoms for head and neck cancers?
Again, you know, there's some sort of classic ones. I think the ones that are important to recognize are pretty straightforward. They tend to be associated with the tumor growth itself. So an example is being a lesion that doesn't heal, a painful mass, those types of things are very common. However, it's also important for individuals to recognize the fact that there are some sort of subtle things that are important to pick up on, like a lymph node in the neck or a lump in the neck that may not even be painful, that just isn't normal for them. I use the analogy in my patients where women are taught to do self-breast exams because we're asking people to find subtle changes. And so if you're noticing lumps or bumps in your neck that weren't there weeks before, you know, it's important for your primary care doc to take a feel of those, because one of the primary signs of early malignancy is a lymph node in the neck that can be completely painless. It's just enlarged. And then a good examination will identify an early malignancy. So we like people to be aware of change. But like you say, these other things are also important. If you have an ulcer in the mouth that you thought was a canker sore that's not healing, that's not normal. So if something doesn't feel normal to you, I think it's really valuable to have a physician look at that area.
Take a look at it, yep. Sure. Well, Carla and Osceola, will turn to you now. Thank you for calling. Hello.
Hello. I have a question regarding burns. I repeatedly burn the roof of my mouth on hot coffee, and I want to know if that repeated insult leaves me more vulnerable to a cancer.
You know, Carl, it's a good question, and I think that that some people would say that repeated injuries is associated with increased chance of a malignancy. I'd say that would be very low increased chance. But, you know, I think that if you add on things such as cigarette smoking or alcohol use, open wounds in the oral cavity certainly are then going to be more exposed to, say, a carcinogen. If you're a non-smoker and these are just superficial burns, you know, the probability is extremely low that you're at reasonably higher risk. So I wouldn't worry about it too much, although it's not a lot of fun to burn your mouth with a cup of coffee. So I can certainly feel poorly about that. Does that help?
Yes, it did. Thank you very much.
Yep, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. And let's turn to Jamie in Wausau. Hi, Jamie.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My question is, I'm wondering what support kinds of opportunities are out there for people with these types of cancers. I work for an organization that does a marriage retreat for couples touched by cancer, and I have not been able to find anything for the lesser common types of cancer to reach out to these people.
All right, let's, Rachel, do you want to chime in here?
Yeah, you know, I guess I can speak from the University of Wisconsin. We're a comprehensive cancer center that deals with many different types of cancer, and with head and neck cancer in particular, we have a excellent team approach to treating cancer, where multiple disciplines are involved, including nursing, nutrition, speech pathology, psychology, social work, occupational therapy, physical therapy. In addition to that, there we have support groups for several, many sites of cancer at UW. And today I wanted to be sure to announce our head and neck cancer support group that meets on a monthly basis to provide support and education to our patients who are undergoing treatment or who are survivors and are years out. So that's what we have at UW. But if you go online or call the National cancer institutes, often they'll have listings of support groups in different sites of cancer, or even calling our UW Cancer Connect phone number, which is 1-800-622-8922. We may be able to provide some guidance in finding support for you.
Okay, that's 800-622-8922. Okay. Does that help, Jamie?
That does. Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you very much for calling. You can join in, too, at 1-800-642-1234 or email us at talk@wpr.org. We'd love to hear from you. Symptoms, we talked a little bit about symptoms. How about diagnosing? You need to get in and see a doctor, I assume, if you're...
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, I think the diagnosis of the cancer requires a physician's intervention, and in almost all cases requires some form of actual tissue biopsy to be done. Because it is important that we don't assume somebody has a malignancy until it's proven. Obviously, there are things that mimic malignancies, infectious diseases, those types of things. Occasionally, the traumas, as mentioned before, and so we want to get it right. So it absolutely requires a good evaluation, and it's predicated on an appropriate biopsy read by a good pathologist to confirm the actual presence of the disorder.
Yeah, so you can't tell just by looking at it.
You know, you can't tell just by looking at it. Those of us that do this day in, day out, you know, will oftentimes think we can, but we also occasionally are fooled, and so we would absolutely never begin a therapeutic course without confirmation with a pathologist.
And treatments, there are a lot of, I assume it, a lot depends on where the cancer is and what type of cancer it is, but there have to be a variety of treatments, I assume.
You know, again, a great question, and fortunately there are a variety of treatments, and we have the opportunity to bring them all to bear in many individuals. And the interesting thing about the cancer world is that the treatments change on almost a yearly basis. We're very well connected with not only our region of experts and local region of experts, but we are very well connected with the entire nation of experts. And so as new treatments come online, we tend to evaluate them and adopt those that are appropriate. But the classic treatments tend to be surgery, radiation therapy, and now combinations of radiation therapy plus chemotherapy. And I might actually direct this to Rachel for just a sec here, because part of the treatment plan involves sort of that prophylaxis against side effects. And so part of our treatment plan is very comprehensive. And so Rachel can tell us a little bit about how that starts.
And we'll have her talk about that right after we take a look at the news here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking about head, neck, and oral cancers today, Larry Mueller here with my two guests, Dr. Timothy McCulloch, otolaryngologist at the UW Hospitals and Clinics, Rachel Kammers, a clinical speech-language pathologist in the Department of Surgery and Otolaryngology. Great to have them along, and thank you for listening in. Lots of callers online, but before we go to the phones, Rachel, there's a free oral cancer screening we should probably mention now and maybe later again, too.
Yes, on April 14th at the UW Hospital, we are holding a free oral cancer screening, and that will be from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. It will take place in the ENT clinic, which is near the atrium. But when you come into the hospital, there will be people to direct you, and there is free parking. And so you would be examined by a physician in your mouth to see if there's anything suspicious for oral cancer. And if there is something suspicious seen, you'll be referred for a more thorough workup with a ENT physician.
So that's Wednesday, the 14th of April
mm-hmm.
at the UW.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and I expect it's probably something online. If people want to, could go to the UW Hospital's website or something like that.
Absolutely. Yeah. In fact, uwhealth.org/cancer is the Cancer Center's website, and there'll be information on there. You can also call 263-6190, that's area code 608, and ask for Peggy Wiederholt or Rachel Kammer. Either of us can talk with you if you have further questions.
And I'm wondering, too, we'll go to the phones, clinical trials like chemo prevention, research studies, anything like that available for patients with head and neck cancers?
Well, it's, again, a great question. I think that the whole idea of prevention begins at home, as you say, as we want people to develop lifestyles that are less prone to developing malignancies, such as efforts to stop smoking. And certainly we've got clinics that support that type of effort as well. We do have some clinical trials that are NIH-funded that are in the works. There's actually a chemo prevention trial that will open soon. It's actually designed specifically for patients that have what we consider pre-malignancies, which are described as leukoplakic lesions, which tend to be white plaques in the oral cavity, oftentimes something a dentist might see that isn't truly a cancer as of yet, but the belief is that they have a potential to develop, and thus we want to prevent the development from occurring. That trial is will be open soon to individuals that fit that inclusion criteria.
Yeah,
yeah. But they're once the cancers are diagnosed, then we move right on to the therapeutic stuff. And I think the prevention really again starts with that lifestyle stuff. And so cigarette smoking being number one, alcohol kind of number two, but other things can be included.
All right, Anne Marie and Eau Claire, let's turn to you now. Thank you for waiting.
Good morning. My comments will be addressed to Dr. McCullough. My son, after 2 years of complaining, after going to the doctors, after having general physical and et cetera, was not diagnosed at all. And he complained each time that his throat hurts. And the last doctor who had who was supposed to be the best doctor for 2008 told him, go back home, quit smoking. Well, he finally went to urgent care, and the doctor there said, yes, I can feel something, ordered a CAT scan, blood test, and all of that. They lost them for 3 weeks, but anyhow, the end result, my son at the age 47, had squamous cell, pharynx, and hypopharynx, stage 4A. He could not breathe anymore. He could not eat. He lost 40 pounds. He had to have, it's difficult to say.
Yeah.
He had to have a tracheotomy.
Mm-hmm.
He had to add a peg. He has just finished to take, he has just taken his cannula out, the peg inside the throat.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, 3 weeks ago, but he was cancer-free for 7 months, and then they found out just the day before Christmas, we found out that he had the squamous cell that traveled to the lung. So,
That's a sad story. A comment from you, Dr. Kammer?
I'll jump in here as Dr. McCullough. So this story that you tell is sad, and as we began sort of the conversation today about prevention and early interventions, and one of our messages today is hopefully not only to the potential patients out there, but the physicians that might interact with patients that have signs and symptoms of head and neck malignancy, that it does require an appropriate and aggressive workup. And unfortunately, these early cancers can mimic a lot of things. They can mimic infectious disease like laryngitis. They can mimic gastroesophageal reflux disease with sore throats. And so those problems being so common that even physicians can be fooled because the other symptoms may not be there, like a lump or a bump, until later on. And so, again, oftentimes the patient does need to be their own advocate, return to the physicians if they don't get the answers they seek. If their symptoms are not getting better, they need to be persistent. And the hope is to find the cancers as early as we can. We will not always succeed at that. Occasionally these things are very indolent and hidden, and then they do not show up until some relatively severe event occurs, like airway problems. But we never want that to be the case. We always want to find them early where the treatment options are very effective. effective. With regard to your son's condition, I'm hoping that he will do well for a period of time. There are additional therapies that sometimes are brought to bear when the diseases become spread to other locations. And it's a difficult situation, no doubt, and I'm sure sad for the family. But we don't like you being in that scenario, and we'd like to prevent it if we can, and we hope for the best for you and your son.
Thanks, Dr. McCulloch. And thank you for calling, Anne-Marie, and good luck to you, your son, and the rest of your family. Appreciate your call. Nancy in Fenimore, we turn to you next. Nancy, hello. Thank you for calling.
Hi. I was just wondering if there's any evidence of higher cancer rates in the head and neck with all the use of the wireless devices and cell phones and whatnot that we have today.
Yeah, it seems like everybody was walking around with a cell phone stuck to their ear these days. Dr. McCulloch, what do you think?
You know, it's a great question. It's one of those things that that has been debated. And there is no what we would consider a strong medical evidence that the cell phones are setting us up for an increased cancer rate. And the problem is that you obviously have to take into consideration all the other things that occur in our lifestyles, whether it's sitting in front of computers all day with the monitors on, or our utilization of television, or our travel at high altitudes where radiation exposure occurs. And so it's kind of hard to know sometimes when a patient does get a cancer for no good reason why that actually occurred. We certainly want to keep our risks low if we possibly can. And fortunately, the cell phone industry is a little bit aware of the fact that there is some radiation that is induced with cell phone use, and our consumer advocates are trying to pay attention to that, to keep that at an absolute bare minimum if possible. And you know, there's sometimes good reasons to be on the cell phone and good reasons not to be. But I don't think you're increasing your risk of cancer by avoiding the use of a cell phone, at least in this current day and age.
Okay. Thanks, Nancy. And Ted and Spooner, on to you now. Hi, Ted.
Yeah. What is like a spot on the ear, and it looks, and it's a little different colored skin, and then on the inside, some of the cartilage or whatever your ear is formed with is missing or slowly fading away. Does that mean anything?
You know, again, these are great questions, and what you're describing is an abnormality of the skin of the ear, and I would guess in most cases someone's going to find a benign diagnosis for that. As we kind of mentioned before, when there's a concern, it really is imperative that a physician with some knowledge of that region look at it. So your generalist can be a good starting place. A dermatologist would have knowledge about the skin of the ear. The otolaryngologist, and even the screenings that Rachel mentioned earlier, we certainly are willing to look at those types of abnormalities during these screenings. I think it's just one of these things that could certainly be a skin malignancy. Because you just describe it as being abnormal, it's probably valuable to have somebody look at it and make sure that it's not something that needs further therapy, such as a biopsy.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Ted, for calling. And Susie in New Berlin, we're on to you now. Hi, Susie.
Hello. Hi. I had a question for your guests about screening techniques in dental offices. I'm a dental hygienist, and we routinely screen just by looking in the oral cavity and around the chin and that kind of thing. But there are a couple of devices now that are marketed to dental offices for doing oral cancer screenings in the mouth. And I'm wondering if you've heard of any of them, if you have evaluated any of them, if they really are any good, or if they're more of a marketing device.
Okay. Dr. McCulloch?
Again, another kind of complex question. I think that I'm impressed by the fact that our entrepreneurs out there are willing to take on the concept of improving our oral cancer screenings, and so I applaud them for that. You know, your concern, of course, is this just a marketing tool, and it's always hard sometimes to determine what is advantageous and disadvantageous when it comes to something that might actually incur additional cost to, say, a practice, a dental practice, or even a patient. And so we haven't done a thorough examination of any of those new tools. My sense of what I have seen is that they tend to be based on different types of light, wave light.
Right.
And the idea being that it allows the inspector to get a better view of the area at particular interest and perhaps pick something up that they would have otherwise missed. And I'm not sure that the education involved in that is going to bear out to the advantage of the examiner or the patient. I think it's the imperative part of this thing is that those of you involved in oral care, a dental hygienist being a great one, my dental hygienist every time I go to the dentist does a great job looking at my oral cavity, gets very familiar with what's normal and abnormal without even these devices mm-hmm. such that you mm-hmm. can pick them up early. I'm not sure that they're going to be a great thing, but when something does come up, I promise you we'll be supportive of it because this is the kind of things we're all seeking to find. I don't think we've quite found it yet, though.
Yeah, okay. Great. Good. Thanks very much.
Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. And there are instances, I know of some, where dental hygienists or the dentist himself or herself has said, this doesn't look good. You better get in and have it taken care of. And turned out to be a very good piece of advice for people.
Absolutely. I mean, they're just our best advocates, those of people that are actually involved in the screening process, and we just love the fact that they're doing that.
Take some more calls here. You can join in, too, by the way. We have an open line or two. We can get you on pretty quickly at 1-800-642-1234 or email at talk@wpr.org. I should mention this email. Tom emailed to ask if cancer can wrap itself around the windpipe, and if so, how is that treated?
Well, again, you know, we kind of alluded to that a little bit earlier in one of the caller's questions, and the concerns that occur is when an individual develops a cancer in the voice box or laryngeal structures, which define kind of the windpipe area, and it can lead to shortness of breath and airway concerns, and it is certainly not infrequent in the world that we practice medicine where patients will come in with shortness of breath or difficulty with their airway, and the diagnosis is truly a malignancy of the voice box that for a variety of reasons got ignored. Sometimes at the patient's choosing, and sometimes just because it just wasn't diagnosed early enough, and we have to deal with that. And it's not a fun thing for anybody, the patient nor the physicians. And absolutely, they can be managed. It just has to be managed appropriately. Most good otolaryngologists have seen this in their practice, at least in their training, and know what to do. It does oftentimes require a tracheotomy, which is an incision in the airway below the constriction to relieve the airway symptomatology, and then later good planning for the cancer management.
Brian in Dubuque, Iowa. Let's go to you now. Hi, Brian.
Hi, how's it going?
Good.
I have a kind of a two-part question about thyroid cancer.
Okay.
I just had a nodule on my thyroid gland biopsied yesterday, which I don't know the result. I won't know the results until tomorrow. My question was, I read a study online that thyroid cancer is so slowly growing that it's almost over-diagnosed, where they did autopsies on X amount of people's, and they had found that they had actually died from something other than thyroid cancer, but they had the actual nodules on the thyroid and had the cancer, but had passed away from something else.
Yeah. All right, Dr. McCullough?
Well, you actually bring up two interesting points. One of the callers earlier talked about whether cancer is becoming more common. And the one cancer that we're actually finding evidence of that being more common is thyroid cancer. And I think you also bring up the point that thyroid cancer is relatively common as we get older. And so I think you're referring to some studies that were done a while back in which individuals at the time of their death had their thyroids examined. And many of them had thyroid cancers that did not lead to their demise, but were actually present and just a part of their lifestyle. That occurs also with things like prostate cancer. But nonetheless, you sound like a young individual, and if you've got a nodule in your thyroid, it's something that should obviously be biopsied, and they did that appropriately, it sounds like. And if it turns out that they are diagnosing a thyroid malignancy, I would imagine that they will recommend appropriate mm-hmm. surgical and other management techniques, and I'd encourage you to follow through with that. I think that many individuals will live a long time with thyroid cancers, but there are individuals that still die of that disease, especially if they go untreated or treated inappropriately. So it's really important that you follow up with treatment recommendations.
Can I ask you one more quick question? I had also read, now I eat a vegan diet, and I'm curious, one of the main things I eat is broccoli, which I've recently discovered has a goitrogen substance in it that leaches iodine from the body and can cause goiters. And that's what I was diagnosed with multinodular goiter, and then with the one nodule that was like 1.8 centimeters. Is it practical to think that somebody could give themselves that if they're not getting enough iodine in their diet?
Bring up some interesting questions. I mean, it used to be that iodine-related goiters were extremely common, and because we had a very iodine-deficient diet. Iodine is much more common now. It's in breads. It's in salts. So we see it in all kinds of products. So it's much, much, much less common to actually have goiters induced by iodine absence. But nonetheless, one of the other diagnoses short of cancer is truly that is a goiterous change in the thyroid gland, which is just described as multinodular goiter. And sometimes it's just common cyst that will manifest with the goiterous change. And it could be partly dietarily induced.
Interesting. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Maybe we, Rachel, maybe we could talk a little bit more about rehabilitation support options that are available for people.
And particularly at the University of Wisconsin at our Comprehensive Cancer Center, we have just a great team of multiple disciplines that help to rehabilitate patients as they're going through treatment. And so it's really a team approach from so many different healthcare providers, from physicians down to nurses, other support staff, therapies, psychology, social work, etc. And really, you get the best care when you can get support from all levels of care. So it's very important that when you're seeking care for cancer, that you seek out a facility that can provide comprehensive care like that.
Let's turn to Jim in Watertown. Jim, hello to you. Thank you for calling.
Thank you. My question is, I've been diagnosed with plantis in the mouth. They're white, spidery type lesions that are come and go. Are they known to be cancerous over the long term?
Are they possibly cancerous, Dr. McCulloch?
You know, another good question. This idea of lichen planus in the oral cavity is not uncommon. I think it falls into the category of a chronic oral cavity irritant. Individuals that have that disorder for a long, long time, lifelong, I think do have a slightly higher risk of malignancy. It's not something that's easily measurable, but certainly just in my clinical practice, I have seen many patients that have had that diagnosis over a period of 20 years and then do manifest with a malignancy. Again, it's sometimes you wonder if it's associated with the problem itself or some of the habits that are commonly seen in individuals with cancer, such as cigarette smoking. So I certainly would encourage individuals that have the disorder of planus or lichen planus in the oral cavity, try to avoid the things like the carcinogens that we know exist, like the cigarette smoke and the smokeless tobaccos, so that you don't double your risk factors. But I think there is a little bit of an association, whether it's a true risk factor or just an association, I couldn't tell you today. But nonetheless, I think it's good advice to keep your lifestyle clean.
All right.
Yeah, I'm not a non-smoker. I mean, I don't smoke. I guess does this ever go away? I mean, if it's first diagnosed with it, is that something you have for life then?
Commonly, it's something that you'll have on and off throughout your life, depending on a variety of things going on, stresses and the like. So it's unlikely that it'll completely disappear from your life. But you may have times of relief and then other times where it's a little bit more of a problem.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks very much for calling. And I want to go back to this free oral cancer screening. Rachel, can you tell us about that again?
Yes, on April 14th at the UW Hospital in the ENT Clinic, from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m., we will be doing free oral cancer screenings. There is free parking at the UW that day. And so when you come in, you will be seen by a physician who will do an examination of your mouth, your oral cavity, and look for any signs of oral cancer. And if something is seen, if something is suspicious, then you'll be referred to have a more thorough workup.
These kinds of things go around. We find them in other places. Milwaukee, for example, might they have those kinds of things as well? A person should probably contact their local hospital if they're not.
Yes, Frederick Hospital is also sponsoring an oral cancer screening. Oh. This is National Head and Neck Cancer Awareness Month, and the week of April 12th in particular, across the country, there will be oral cancer screenings during that week. So we have one in Madison, and Milwaukee has one as well, and there's
many
sites.
Maybe one in Marshfield and other places as well, sure.
Yeah.
So it's, if you're not in the Madison area,
yeah,
well, you can.
And if you go to the Oral Head and Neck Cancer Awareness Week website, and that's ohncaw.org, there's plenty of information about the national, the different national sites for oral cancer screenings, and you can look at the map and see if there's one near you.
Near you. Well, I want to thank you both very much for being with us today. It's a real treat, and I hope we have a chance to talk again. Thank you very
much. Welcome. Thank you.
Dr. Timothy McCulloch is an otolaryngologist, chairs the Department of Otolaryngology at the UW-Madison Hospitals and Clinics. Rachel Kammer, a clinical speech-language pathologist in the Department of Surgery and Otolaryngology. And we'll have them back. And again, the UW website, go to uwhealth.org/cancer. Thank you for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store.